Welcome to episode 3 of Midwest Magic. I'm your host, Ethan Richardson, with my co-host,
Justin Washburn.
And today's a very special episode. Today is the day we get to talk about SCG Chicago, which is really exciting, what with, you know, the whole theme of the podcast being Midwest Magic, and Chicago is in the Midwest. I don't know if they've ever had a GP or anything in Chicago. I would imagine.
I couldn't tell you.
Well, you're useless to me then.
Well.
Okay, so for SCG Chicago, very interesting tournament overall. There was a lot of kind of crazy stuff being played, being week one of Standard. But we're going to talk a little bit about the top eight, and then we're going to talk about some brews and other deck lists we liked. So the first deck that won was Tuan Nguyen. I don't know if I said his first name right at all. I dated a girl who had the same last name, so I'm pretty sure I got that one. But he was playing green red devotion. Justin, what's your take on devotion as a whole? Before we get into the deck list, what do you think about the green red devotion strategy?
I would like to say green X, because there are different versions of green devotion that are splashing for different colors for different options. You have the green red that splashes mainly for Xenagos, the Planeswalker, and Dragonlord Atarka, because those are really good cards. But then you have like green white devotion that splashes for like Mastery of the Unseen and Dromoka's Command and like Valor Stance, like some actual removal that you can have in the game. That way you're not just like, oh, I can't deal with that dumb thing and I died because of a Dragonlord Atarka when I could have Valor Stanced it.
Right, and I like this green red devotion list that won first because it's just a little bit different than some of the other ones. It's just got the one thing that kind of sets it apart is the one Ash Cloud Phoenix and the one edition of Sword of the Animist that he's got. So the full list has 31 creatures. It's one Ash Cloud Phoenix, 4 Elvish Mystic, 2 Genesis Hydra, 1 Hornet Queen, 4 Rattleclaw Mystic, 4 Sylvan Caryatid, 4 Whisperwood Elemental, 4 Courser of Kruphix, 3 Dragonlord Atarka, 4 Pelugrinos World Eater. It's got 4 Planeswalkers, 1 Ugin the Spirit Dragon, 3 Xenagos the Reveler. It has 1 Sword of the Animist, which is the new artifact. And then it's got some land, including 3 Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, and 1 Haven of the Spirit Dragon. And the sideboard is 2 Arbor Colossus, 4 Gaia's Revenge, 2 Mistcutter Hydra, 4 Nylea's Disciple, 2 Barrage of Boulders, and 1 Seismic Rupture. Now, one thing I noticed is that most of the green lists in general added Nissa to their mix, and this one didn't. It has just the Sword of the Animist, which I believe, other than if we exclude the sideboard, this is the only Origins card in the 60. What do you think about not including Nissa?
I don't know. I feel like Nissa is a powerful card, but he is running an Ugin in the main board, which is also something that the green red devotion lists don't do. They run him in the sideboard because they don't like wiping their own field. Like, it's all about building devotion. He also has like one of Hornet Queen, which Hornet Queen is a great devotion, but like with Languish in the format now, Hornet Queen just is terrible.
You know, I found that interesting. I watched almost the entire tournament. I missed a lot of the top eight because I had to do some work, but I only ever saw Languish cast once as far as what I watched. I may have missed it, you know, but I was surprised to not see more of it.
Well, I'm pretty sure there's an article on SEG where they did do a day two tournament breakdown of what decks were in day two. 35% of the format was Obs on Control. And all those lists basically had Languish in them.
Interesting. I must have just missed those matches.
Yeah, like, they really never got any feature matches, so we really never even seen it. But Languish is just a really good card, because due to the fact that Dragonlord Ojutai has 4 toughness, and your Siege Rhino has 5, you can kill a Dragonlord Ojutai and still have a Siege Rhino.
With Wynn's list here, what do you think was the thing that brought it above all the other green-red strategies? Was it just his tight play, or was there anything about the list itself, do you think, put him ahead?
I don't know. Ash Cloud Phoenix is interesting, though. If you do, you can, like, since it is the double red, and, like, you have two mountains and four temples, like, you're gonna have enough red. Maybe his plan was just to, like, get to a point where it's like, you have to deal with this giant flyer. Oh, you killed it. Oh, I'm just gonna flip it back up and I'm gonna keep shooting you. Also, I think Ashcloud Phoenix is good because, like, all the other, like, green red devotion lists don't run, like, any flyers. Like, they run maybe a couple Arbor Colossus in the main board, even if that. But green red devotion has a Dragon Lord Tarka, and that's it. But Ashcloud Phoenix can come down so early that it could matter.
Do you think it was a meta call, or do you think it's just a little fun addition?
I think it's just a fun, spicy thing. Like, maybe he was just going through, and he was just like, well, I don't want a second Hornet Queen, and I don't want, like, a third Genesis Hydra. What else would be, like, pretty good? And Ashcloud Phoenix is good, because even if it gets manifested, you can flip it up. You can flip it up for four, and its ability still triggers.
Right. And then, I guess, my last wonder about this, the 60, is the one of Sword of the Animist. Now, if you're not familiar with the card, Sword of the Animist is a legendary artifact equipment that costs two colorless. An equipped creature gets +1/+1, and whenever the equipped creature attacks, you may search your library for a basic land card, put it onto the battlefield tapped, then shuffle your library, and it costs two to equip. I didn't see any games where this was used, but again, that was just what I was able to watch. Do you know if it really came to be relevant at any point?
I didn't really get to see much of the top eight except for a little bit of the semifinals, like the end of the semifinals, and then just the finals. Just like, okay, so I can pump, like, my Mystic or my Courser. Like, Courser's a 3/5 now. It's beating my enemy down, I'm also ramping. So it seems like a good one of.
Okay, and then the last bit for the sideboard then is the four of Gaia's Revenge. And Gaia's Revenge is an 8/5 elemental creature that costs 7/5 and 2 green. Gaia's Revenge can't be countered, it has haste, and it can't be the target of non-green spells or abilities from non-green sources. Clearly that's something that comes in against control decks. Because that card is just insane, and part of me wonders if it's worth running main board, just because having an 8/5 with haste that you can easily cast just sounds amazing.
Yeah, it seems really good. Blueback Control can't do anything to it unless they have, like, an Ugin in their hand, but even then they have to play the Ugin, and then -7 their Ugin, kill their own Ugin to get this off the board. They also have Perilous Vault is about the only thing.
You know, actually, I heard of some spicy tech that I think it was Tom Ross was going for, was Sultai Charm.
Yeah, you would just splash green for Sultai Charm.
Yep.
And that way you have, like, it also fuels your dig through time because you can draw two and discard one. You can kill a monocolored creature or something that just more kill spell.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's some spicy tech against the green-red devotion thing, if they're running the Gaia's Revenge. Overall, I mean, the list seems pretty solid. I mean, it's got all the good stuff that's been piloting green-red devotion to success for a long time.
Yeah, there's not really anything from Origins that can really improve the list to the point where it's, like, game-breaking. Like, Gaia's Revenge is really good for the deck. It's really good for just green decks in general. I love that card so much.
I, you know, didn't really even think much about it because I, again, haven't had as much time to devote to Magic Origins as I would like, but that card looks insane. All right, congratulations, Mr. Wynn, for your victory on Star City Games Chicago. Let's move down to the second place list. Justin, if you want to take that one.
Logan Mize plays second with Blue-White Heroic. He's not splashing green for the Dromoka's Command. He's not doing any of that silly shenanigans. He's just, I'm going to play Blue-White, and I'm just going to beat you down. He has four Battlewise Hoplite, four Favorite Hoplite, four Hero of Iroas, two Lagona Band Trailblazers, and two Seeker of the Way. He's got 20 land, which is pretty average. He has four Aqueous Form, four Ordeal of Heliod, four Ordeal of Thassa, two Ajani's Presence, four Defiant Strike, four God's Willing, and two Stubborn Denial. The sideboard, one Lagona Band Trailblazer, two Monastery Mentor, two Seeker of the Way, two Stratus Walk, one Ajani's Presence, two Disdainful Stroke, two Stubborn Denial, one Triton Tactics, and two Treasure Cruise.
Okay, so here's my problem with this list. Now, obviously, I don't have too much authority to speak, considering I've never top two'd an SCG event. However, there are no cards from Dragons of Tarkir, and there are no cards from Origins. This guy's completely missed out on like the last two sets with this list, and it didn't matter at all.
Yeah, like he, the big addition to the heroic list was Dromoka's Command, and Tom Ross has been a big supporter of it. But I think Logan Mai is like, I think he totally just metagame called on this one. Like, he was just like, why do I have to worry about like three colors and worrying about this like Dromoka's Command when I could just go full blown Aqueous Form Ordeals, pump a big dude and kill you in the air because you can't block it or you can't kill it. And even if you try to kill it, I have like Ashanti's Presence and God's Willing. I really like it. He also has like two Stratus Walk in the sideboard to even be like punishing those devotion lists that don't have flyers. So like, I am going to make a big flying dumb idiot and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always, well, I should rephrase. I've never been a fan of the heroic strategy, just because, I mean, if you break it down, there are so many weaknesses, but for some reason, it just is able to get the kill so much quicker, and it's a crazy strategy in general, and the fact that this list doesn't need anything from the last two sets to be able to overtake the tier one decks that were rampant, especially with the, amount of like Abzan control and stuff like that was being played. It's a little depressing, really.
Yeah, maybe he just didn't see any of those like Obzon matchups because it kind of goes 50-50 with Obzon and Blue-White Heroic in my opinion. If the heroic player mulligans even once, it just gets worse for them. And I'm pretty sure in the finals, Logan Mai's mulliganed to three in the final match against Wynn, and I think that's just what ended it because he couldn't do anything. He put up a good fight though. He put up a very good fight, even mulliganing to three.
Yeah, that's one thing about that heroic deck is, you have to mulligan pretty aggressively, but because it can operate on so little mana and so little investment on some things, it can still get quite a victory in.
Yeah, the last time I know for a fact that Ordeal of Thassa has always been a 4 of, but the 4 of Ordeal of Heliod seems really good too, because even if you're playing against a control player, you've got 10 more life. Control players have enough problems dealing with 20 life or like 19 or 18, but just going up to 30 is pretty amazing. Like, usually you only see Ordeal of Heliod in like the sideboard, just against the like really aggressive mono red decks or burn decks. But like, honestly, I think he just thought, well, I'm just gonna keep pumping dudes, drawing cards, gaining a bunch of life, and
Yeah, I think I saw him up to like 40 some life in one game. It was insane. It's kind of like it was one of those like, how do you come back from that?
you
You
really don't.
get so far behind that it starts to not even matter. And then like I can't remember which game match it was, but whoever he was playing against had, a big flyer or something like that and was just hitting him every turn with it, and he was just like, okay, I'm at 42, I don't care.
Yeah.
It's just so weird to see a deck that doesn't have any new cards in it in a week one standard, but I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I guess.
Yep.
Moving down to third place, Ross Miriam, another, fairly known Star City Games player, also playing Green Red Devotion. A little more of a stock list, but this one did add the Nissa, so the creatures are 33. It's four Elvish Mystic, three Genesis Hydra, one Hornet Queen, four Rattleclaw Mystic, four Sylvan Caryatid, four Whisperwood Elemental, four Courser of Kruphix, three Dragonlord Atarka, two Nissa Vastwood Seer, and four Pelucranos World Eater. It's got three Planeswalkers in Xenagos the Reveler, and then the sideboard is one Arbor Colossus, two Gaia's Revenge, three Nylea's Disciple, two Plummet, two Nissa World Waker, one Ugin the Spirit Dragon, two Roast, and two Seismic Rupture. So we see that this also has the Gaia's Revenge in the sideboard for the control matchups. But other than that, it's a pretty stock list other than adding the Nissa and then having additional Nissa in the sideboard. Do you think that adding the Nissa Vastwood Seer helped the deck get ahead.
Just judging by it, you have four Mystics, four Rattleclaw, four Caryatid. That's 12 dorks. But then you also have Nissa, that's going to get you a land. And even though it's a two of, like, it's also really good early game because, like, if you're struggling to get land drops and you're just depending on dorks, then Nissa's like, okay, I'm going to help you out. But then, like, in the late game, when you're like, have a couple Whisper Woods going and a Pulcrinos, and you just want all these mana sinks, Nissa's such a good top deck. And then she'll just probably more likely just flip into the Planeswalker. And then what's your opponent going to do?
Not a thing. So let's talk about Nissa's Planeswalker form after you flip her a little bit. I like the synergy so well with Courser of Kruphix for the plus one ability, which I didn't see used all that often. I mean, if you're flipping Nissa, you're probably not trying too hard to get more land onto the battlefield. But I just like that, you know, if you've got a couple coursers on the field and you're kind of dirtling until you get a big win condition, you can just gain life like no other. With
Yeah, Nissa's really good with Courser, because even if you play to land that turn, Nissa doesn't care because just how it's worded. It's like if it's a non-land card, you just draw it. But if it's a land, you just put it on the battlefield. It just really helps. It just accelerates you.
Yeah, and I saw in feature matches her minus two get used a couple times where you put a legendary 4/4 green elemental creature token named Ashaya, the Awoken World, onto the battlefield.
Yeah, the ability on turn 7 to play Nissa, get a forest, play the forest, flip Nissa, make a 4/4 just for 3 mana, and you still have 4 lands. You can even just Seed Rhino, make your opponent more salty.
Gross.
It's just great.
Gross. Like, when cards come out, do you just instantly think of how you can apply it to Seed Rhino?
Yeah. It's like
Yeah,
Seed Rhino is like this gang lord. And like when new people are coming around his hood, he's gotta like check them out and be like, "All right, Nissa, I see you. You look good. You should come over, hang out sometime."
that
I don't
literally made me shudder.
know.
Anyway, so yeah, it's a pretty stock green-red list. The only red being Xenagos and Dragonlord Atarka in the main, and then we have other Nissa in the side. Nissa Worldwaker from M15, which I've always liked this card just because there are some pretty good strategies that it can just hose.
Yeah, it's really good against control. It's just like be able to just have, like make your lands 4/4s with trample. Like control's just like gross. And then like even ability to just like play Nissa, untap your 4/4s, and then like still have like a Nykthos open or something, and then just start Nykthosing and
You're
like you can do
terrible.
a lot.
That's terrible.
What can I say? I'm a green player.
So yeah, that's Ross Miriam's list. Like I said, pretty good. Ross had some good, you know, solid play throughout the whole tournament. Leading him to third. Chris Anderson came in at fourth with another green red devotion list. Do you really want to spend time on that? Or I think we kind of
The
beat.
only change is that instead of three Dragonlord Atarka, he went to the full four, which I do like. You want to see a lot in your matchups. But then he has three Genesis Hydra, but he doesn't have any spicy one ofs. Like he has three Deafness Raptor instead, which I really love Deafness Raptor in it.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to me, especially with like Huynh's list that had the Ashcloud Phoenix and the Rattleclaw Mystics. It seems like you could really exploit the Deathmist Raptor mechanic with that.
Yeah, with my green-white devotion list that I'm running the full four Deathmist, because every game that like you're manifesting, like even if it's a Mystic, you just flip it up and you get like your Deathmist back. You trigger your mastery, you gain a bunch of life. It's just really solid. My list also consists of two Den Protector, just because Den Protector is good.
Yeah,
Plus
and
turning.
more exploitation with the flipping.
Yeah, and you can return like, oh, they just dealt with like my Pulcrinos, my Whisper Wood. Oh, I'll just return my Whisper Wood to my hand and play it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we kind of beat the green red devotion horse little bit here with how much it showed up so far, but I really wanted to talk about Abzan Control, which is fifth with Bruce Edelman. Why don't you take us through that list, Justin?
All right, well, he's got 2 Dim Protector, 4 Siege Rhino, 4 Corsair of Kruphix, 3 Nissa Vastwood Seer, 2 Tassigur, the Golden Fang. He has 3 Planeswalkers, which are 3 Elspeth, Sun's Champion. And then he's got 4 Abzan Charm, 4 Heroes Downfall, 1 Ultimate Price, 3 Languish, and 4 Thoughtseize. And then he's got 26 land, which is pretty average. That sideboard's really awesome. He's got 2 Urshan Cleric, 3 Fleece Maned Lion, 2 Dromoka's Command, 2 Ultimate Price, 1 Underend, 1 Nissa Worldwaker, 1 Sorin Solemn Visitor, 1 Ugin the Spirit Dragon, 1 Crux of Fate, and 1 of Duress.
That is a spicy sideboard.
Pretty spicy. It's pretty average until you get to like the Underend, and then you're just like, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. So, what are your thoughts? Like, to me, when I think of a control deck, I mean, 15 creatures still seems like quite a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a bit to call it control, but at the same time, it's got 16 spells. So they're kind of, it's like 50-50. It's more like, I would consider it more mid-range, but I think the reason why people are calling it Abzan Control is that you have your 3 Elspeth that are your top end that just take over the game. But before that, you're controlling their board. Like you're getting your land drops from Corsair. You're Abzan Charming, getting stuff out of the way, Heroes Downfalling, Languish the whole board. You just get to this late game where you're just gonna play your like Elspeth or your Siege Rhino and you're just gonna kill them because you're gonna keep everything off the board.
Right. Now, the reason this deck interests me so much is it's kind of the creature complement. Like, you have Tassigur, which is just a good kind of beat down win condition and survives Languish, but also has the card advantage of being able to dump things into your graveyard and get stuff back. So that makes sense to me. Same with Den Protector. Those creatures in there make sense because you get that card advantage of being able to get things out of the graveyard. Siege Rhino, of course, makes sense because Abzan colors, and you should be running Siege Rhino. But where I kind of don't know how I feel about it is with the four Coursers. Do you think that's just straight up answer to aggro, or do you think gaining that life and knowing the top card of your library is that important?
Gaining the life and knowing the top of the library is very important. Plus, it's a 2/4. So mono red like goblins or aggro just has a tr they hate Corsair. I hate Caryatid and Corsair. They're like best buddies. There's no Caryatids in this list, but being able to hit your land drops with such a like top end as Elspeth, you want to get to a point where you Abzan drop like you need to start playing 2 spells a turn in the late game, because that's going to be the deal breaker in like the mid range and the control matchups, is you being able to play multiple spells in one turn. So hitting the land drops is very crucial, and I think that's why Corsair's in the list, because you look at the top and then you get to play that land that you don't want to draw.
Yeah, I like the list overall. I mean, it's definitely solid. Abzan has proven itself multiple times over and over ever since Khanzatar Gear came out. So I think we'll be seeing a lot of Abzan for a while. Now, with Edelman's sideboard, it seems a little toolboxy towards the end there, where he's just got so many one-ofs with the three different planeswalkers as one-ofs, and then the one of Utter End. What do you make of those?
The Utter End is interesting, but I can see why it's there, because there's going to be points where you just need an extra. It's just an extra removal spell, but it can also get rid of things like Mastery of the Unseen. Like, if you're going against a green-white devotion and they're just doing this silly nonsense of, I'm just going to keep getting all this life and you can't kill me. It also, like, Jeskai Ascendancy tokens, that's starting to get some more popularity again, so I could see why the one of Ultimate. Utter End is in there. I don't know. I've always liked Utter End as a card, but it just doesn't fit in the main board.
I have too. I think Utter End is one of those cards that is going to see a lot of play come rotation.
Yeah, it gets rid of like planeswalkers and even the creature planeswalkers, like it exiles them, and then it also exiles like a Deathmist Raptor or a Den Protector, so they can't loop them again. Deals with a lot of things. I wish there were more copies in the sideboard, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's always one that, I mean, I understand why it's not played in a lot of main boards, but at the same time, it just seems like it's almost good enough to be. It's kind of, I think, Ojitai's Command is facing that a lot right now too. Like, it's got a lot of good qualities that make it a solid card, but like, if it was one less mana, it would be seeing so much play.
Pretty much be broken.
Exactly.
Like utter end would just become vindicate.
Moving on to sixth place was Kevin McCleskey with Jeskai Tokens, and I've been a huge fan of Jeskai Tokens ever since. Who was it? Watanabe, I think, played it at Worlds, and you kind of had an I got the idea of how amazing and broken Jeskai Ascendancy could be in Standard, other than the janky combo. Jeskai Tokens has kind of dropped off the map for a while. Why was that?
I think a lot of it is just Obzon running around. And with Obzon, you got Bioblight and Drowned in Sorrow before Origins. So it's kind of. And now they have Languish, so it's even worse, even if you'd like. Because with like Bioblight and Drowned in Sorrow, you could actually like chain some spells and have your tokens survive as 1/1s. But with Languish, it's like you have to go like the super extra mile to survive just the Languish.
Yeah, I think also Dromoka's Command did a lot to kind of sink it, because without Jeskai Ascendancy, the deck just does not work as well.
You have to force them to sack their ascendancy, and then you fight like this list has Fort Jace, the new Jace. Like you have fight their Jace. Like then they're just like, well, I've got to try to do something here, or
And
I'm
there's.
just dead in the water.
Yeah, there's not a lot you can do. So this list runs eight creatures, four Seeker of the Way, four Jace Vryn's Prodigy. It's got 24 lands, and then 28 spells. Four Jeskai Ascendancy, two Lightning Strike, two Ojitai's Command, three Raise the Alarm, one Secure the Wastes, four Stoke the Flames, three Wild Slash, one Dragon Fodder, four Hordling Outburst, and four Treasure Cruise. The sideboard includes three Sphinx's Tutelage, four Disdainful Stroke, two Negate, two Valorous Dance, one Dragonlord Ojitai, two Anger of the Gods, and one Roast. Jeskai Tokens has always been a build based off of the spells that make tokens. I didn't get to actually see many of the matches. I don't think it was featured all that often with this list. Do you know how Jace performed?
I have no clue, but I did see Jerry Thompson playing like Jeskai mid-range, not the tokens build, but he had Jace in it, and it was just so good in the late game just to draw a card and then discard that land that you had in your hand, like you're just drawing, and then when it flips, it's just like, okay, I've got a Jace Planeswalker now, and you have to deal with it, or if it ultimates, you're pretty much screwed.
Yeah, they get screwed, and also, I mean, even just the being able to flashback spells from the graveyard is really, really helpful in a list like Jeskai Tokens.
Yeah, kind of eating my own words because I during pre-release I'm like, oh, Jace won't see play. It's terrible. Like, why would it ever see play in Standard? Maybe in Modern, maybe, but Standard, I don't really think there's a place for it. But there is a place for it. It's in Jeskai Tokens.
Well, and I've seen it in a lot of different places, and it's funny because I know a couple of people who are saying that, it was garbage and nobody was ever going to play it, and it was going to be a $2 planeswalker by the end of it all. It's going to be the next Tybalt. And I kind of knew it wasn't going to be. I think I'm going to try testing it in my Modern Grixis Delver just to see. I'm not, too invested in it being a game-breaking card, but I think it has its uses, and I think people were just not giving the draw a card, discard a card enough credit, because that is, a pretty solid ability, because especially in something like Jeskai Tokens, where you can have cards you don't exactly need at that moment.
Yeah, I've been kind of brewing a Soul Tide Delve list for Standard with like Tassigers and Gurmog Anglers, and using Jace and then like Jace the Living Guild back from M15 because this +1 is pretty sure it's draw two and discard one or something like that. It's along those lines where you're just like drawing and discarding, and then along with the new Jace, you're filling your graveyard, and then you just play Gurmog Angler and Tassigger on the same turn and.
That's dirty.
Yeah. I mean, I have it somewhat built. It's like 75% the way there, but.
Chess Kai Ascendancy is no secret that it can be abused and can be broken, and when you watch it go off with the Jeskai tokens build, it's just it you feel dirty just watching someone play it too, because it there's so many spells getting cast in the same turn sometimes. But I mean, overall it's good to see the deck coming back a little bit. I don't think it's gonna last. I think with a build like Jeskai tokens, you have to be a very good player in order to beat the harder decks.
Plus, not that you just have to sequence everything perfectly.
Well, exactly.
I saw a lot of people when the silly Dragon Fodder Retraction Helix combo was a thing, and a lot of people were just like, "Yeah, I can play that. That doesn't seem hard." I'm like, "It is a very hard deck because you have to sequence it and stack it just right."
Exactly.
But just got like with this newer version, you don't really have to do the janky combo, but you still have to sequence it in a way that a lot of players just don't understand that when you have to pump your goblins, you should attack with them first, see if they block, and then if they block, like, all right, I'm just going to do all these silly things, and I'm going to build them up to like five fives, and oh, your whole board's dead.
So, okay, let's move on to the next list. At seventh place, Jeff Hoogland's list of blue-white control. Justin, do you want to take us through this list?
Yep, he's got four creatures. He's got the Hangar Back Walkers. It's a new Origins card. It's an XX that has X and X. Enters the battlefield X 1/1 counters. When it dies, you put a colorless stopped or artifact creature token with flying on the battlefield for each 1/1 counter, and then you can pay one colorless and tap it, and you can put a 1/1 counter on it. That's a really good spicy Origins card.
Yes,
He's
it
also
is.
got three Elspeth Sun's Champion, one Ugin the Spirit Dragon, and he's got 27 lands, which is pretty average. But he has some spicy one-ofs I just want to go over real quick. He's got a one of Radiant Fountain. He's got two Mystic Monastery, which are really neat. And then he's got three Darksteel Citadel. And you'll see why Darksteel Citadel is in the list once we go over the spells. He's got two Thopter Spy Network, which is another new Origins card, which is. See the mana cost. It's two blue and two colorless for an enchantment. Beginning of your upkeep, if you control an artifact, put a 1/1 colorless Thopter artifact creature token with flying onto the battlefield. Whenever one or more artifact creatures you control deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. And then he's got three Artificer's Epiphany, which is blue and two colorless, instant, draw two cards. If you control no artifacts, discard a card, which you're going to be controlling artifacts, so it's just a draw two card.
Yeah,
But
it's a divination,
pretty.
essentially.
Yeah. He's got three Clash of Will, four Dig Through Time, one Disdainful Stroke, four Dissolve, one Last Breath, two Valorous Stance, three Inhostilities, and two Swift Reckoning, which is another new Origins card. White and a colorless for a sorcery. It has Spell Mastery. If there are two or more instant or sorcery cards in your graveyard, you may cast Swift Reckoning as though it had Flash. And then it's just destroy target tap creature. The sideboard is one Perilous Vault, one Hidden Dragon Slayer, two Stratus Dancer, one Disdainful Stroke, one Faded Retribution, three Last Breath, two Negate, one Raise the Alarm, one Valorous Stance, and two Displacement Wave.
So this list is, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know how I feel about it overall. Obviously, Jeff did very well with it, and he knew the list, but I think it just falls a little bit short in that I don't think it has quite enough removal.
I mean, he's got Valorous Stance and Hidden Hostilities, but I mean, Last Breath will take care of something.
Right, like Last Breath and Swift Reckoning were the cards I saw do a lot of work for him as far as removal goes. But with his strategy of, building up kind of a Thopter army until he can swing for wins, just seems, or, get Elspeth out and make more tokens, it seems that End Hostilities running three of them might hurt him more than help.
Yeah, it could in some situations, but I think what the plan is getting Thopter Spy Network on the board pretty early, and then just like maybe turn five in hostilities. And like maybe you got rid of like one Thopter, but after that, like you're gonna start building Thopters, And it's really synergistic because you have Ugin, and his mindness ability doesn't kill the Thopters because they're colorless.
Yeah, there's that. The problem I saw with that was it does kill the Thopter spy network, though.
True.
And like it, like I said, obviously it's worked. The hangar backwalkers were, you know, acting as the best two drops from Origins. And the Clash of Wills ended up being a pretty good counter spell for him most of the time, which I'm kind of eating my own words there. But he is only running three. But I, like I said, there, it doesn't seem to be always working with itself. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like blue-white control has always been like a deck on the horizon, and people have always been trying to get it to work because that was the control deck before, like since the beginning of time. Control has always been like blue white, but blue black is just such a better list in my opinion. You get black for the removal, and then you have Ashiok, which is really good right now because of all the creature based decks, and like you could run Perilous Vaults main board. And I think in this list, Perilous Vault main board would be better. But it does get rid of your Thopter Spy Network. I don't know. It's a really interesting list, and I like it.
Okay. Moving on to the 8th place list. List very close to my heart. Mardu Dragons by Matthew Check. Justin, do you want to take us through this list?
Sure thing. He's got 20 creatures. He's got 4 Goblin Rabble Master, 2 Seeker of the Way, 4 Soulfire Grandmaster, 4 Stormbreath Dragon, 4 Thunderbreak Regent, 2 Kolaghan the Storm's Fury, and then he's got 26 land, which is pretty average. And then he's got 14 spells with 4 Crackling Doom, 4 Draconic War, 1 Kolaghan's Command, 1 Murderous Cut, 1 Ultimate Price, and 3 Thoughtseize. And then sideboard, he has 3 Outpost Siege, 3 Foul Tongue Invocation, 2 Breemaz, King of Oreskos, 1 Elspeth Sun's Champion, 3 Anger of the Gods, 1 Crux of Fate, 1 Duress, and 1 Thoughtseize.
Okay, I mean, it seems like a pretty standard Mardu Dragons list. I don't think I see anything from Origins here.
No, there's... Yeah. I mean, I guess if you count Battlefield Forge, since it's a reprint.
Oh, that does not count.
But yeah, he's not running anything from Origins, which we know your feelings on not running anything from new sets.
I know. It just seems like it's so much less fun. I mean, I can't really think of any cards that demand, or from Origins that demand to be run in like a Mardu Dragons list. And I find myself, as I try to brew Mardu lists, I find myself just constantly only taking cards from like Khans of Tarkir or earlier. The Kolaghan the Storm's Fury is always a solid dragon for this list. And he's got the one of Kolaghan's Command, which is still a more recent card. But, yeah, I can't really think of anything from Origins that really needs to be in this list. And obviously it served him well.
Yeah, he did pretty good with it. Mardu Stormbreath Dragon is still a card.
Exactly.
And it's Thunderbreak Regent paired with it. It's just nasty. I'm interested to see Avaricious Dragon. I don't even remember what its name is.
Oh, the Avaricious Dragon?
Yeah, it's like an Outpost Siege, kind of, where you like draw an extra card, but then you have to discard your hand at the end of the turn. Like, I'll be interested to see if the Red Dragons list will incorporate that dragon once Stormbreath is gone.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think without haste, it kind of suffers. I think if anything, that card might show up at the top end of some big red decks. Maybe not so much the dragon strategy, but running it with Thunderbreak seems like a solid plan overall. I could see it showing up in the Mardu or red-black take on the dragon's archetype. Because, you know, red and black, you tend to be dumping your hand pretty quickly.
Yeah, and, like, even if you're discarding, like, if you happen to get your one of Murderous Cut, like, it just feels your delve. I'd be interested to see if, like, maybe you can incorporate, like, since you're doing, like, if you go to that style of deck where you're discarding your hand constantly, maybe more murderous cuts.
Potentially. I like that plan.
It's solid removal. It's solid removal, and you know for a fact that once you play your dragon, that's going to draw you an extra card, which is nice, and then discard your hand. Even if it's two land, it's like, oh, I just fueled my murderous cut that's coming up soon, hopefully. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, I find myself sitting here kind of brewing some Jund ideas with like splashing green instead of white, I think, for like Den Protector to bring some of those cards back to your hand.
Be pretty interesting. You could even just go green red dragons with Den Protector, Death Mist,
And the
Thunder Wave.
Avaricious.
Yeah, because even if like you draw your Death Mist, you're gonna put them in the yard, and they're gonna come
Yep.
back.
Well, good. Well, that's the top eight for SCG Chicago. It was a fun tournament to watch because there's so many goofy deck lists and fun brews with new Origins cards, which is actually what we're going to move into next. There were a lot of fun decks to just kind of watch. So, Justin, what were some of your favorite decks you saw over the weekend?
As I was going through the deck list after the tournament ended, I was hoping that they put it up right away, which they did. One of the like interesting ones I saw in the top 16 was Mono White Devotion. They got 14th place. Jordan Howker-Reed. I know I butchered that last name, but I'm sorry, Jordan, if you're listening to this podcast. Yeah, he's got 26 creatures. He's got four Archangel of Tice, two Hidden Dragon Slayer, four Knight of the White Orchid, four Soldier of the Pantheon, three Wingmate Rock, three Anifenza Kentry Spirit, three Birmaz King of Oreskos, one Kithian Hero of Akros, and two Heliod God of the Sun. And then he's got one Ajani Steadfast. His lands are kind of interesting because he's got just the 20 planes and three Nykthos. But he also has two Foundry of the Councils.
What does that one do?
It's a new land from Origins. You can tap it to add a colorless to your mana pool, and it has a second ability where you pay five and tap it. You sacrifice Foundry of the Councils, put two 1/1 colorless Thopter artifact creatures with flying out of the battlefield.
Huh.
Then he's got eight spells. He's got two Mastery of the Unseen, four Valorous Stance, and two Spear of Heliod.
So did they have this in any feature matches?
I don't know if they did or not. I would have really loved to see. I really want to see this deck in action and see if it actually does perform as well as it did in this tournament.
And where did it place again?
It placed 14th, so it got top
14th. Wow.
14. So maybe it was a game or two shy away from the top eight, it seems like.
Yeah, that would have put him right up there.
Cards in this list, just like the Foundry of the Councils. Like I want to know why there's two. Like maybe just to create some late game Thopters just for beat down in the air. Spear of Heliod is a card we haven't seen in a long, long time.
I don't think
But
I've ever seen that in a top list of anything ever.
I used to run it in like Obzon aggro in the sideboard. Like I used to run two of them in the sideboard for a long time because it pumps up like your Fleece Manes and your Rakshasas and your Rhinos. But it also is just like if they're on like the aggro plan too, I can sit back with my Spear of Heliod and wait for them to hit me and be like, oh, I'll blow up that creature. And then just slowly keep blowing up their creatures with other removal. But it seems really good in this list. Anthem, it's double white in the cost, so it's gonna help your devotion.
Yeah.
And then Heliod, like, is a card that has never really seen any play anywhere.
That's true. And, you know, I think I remember Cedric and Patrick in the coverage saying something about this list and how, you know, Dromoka's Command, again, just kind of made. Was that Destroy Enchantment or is Dromoka's Command Exile Enchantment?
Dromoka's Command, target player
Sacrifice.
sacrifices an enchantment.
Yeah, so I mean that pretty much
Definitely have
wrecked the
Heliod
Theros
and
gods.
Heliod.
That pretty much wrecked the Theros gods.
Yeah, like you don't really see many of the gods lingering around anymore. Mainly just because Dromoka's Command, like there was always enchantment removal, but they were legendary, so it was just like, oh, well, you have to exile us, and then you have Deicide. Then you have Utter End. Like, there's just so much removal for the gods that, like, if you're playing in a metagame that has a bunch of gods floating around, chances are you're going to start seeing a lot more sideboards where they're just like, all right, well, I know he's playing a couple gods. I have to deicide them and get them out.
Yep, I remember when that was first spoiled, and that was the biggest deal in the world, was that, you could just get rid of all of the gods pretty much in their library.
Yep.
What are the lists you got for us?
The other one list that I really enjoyed, Green Black Elves. Now, it didn't place very high. It got 41st.
It's top 64 to over 700 person event. Seems pretty decent.
Yeah, it seems pretty good for just being Green Black Elves. A lot of talk was just like, oh, it just doesn't have the like power or the lords to really just put it over the top like the modern Cocoa Elves list has. But Mr. John Ostrom got 41st place. He's running 31 creatures, 4 Dwinyan's Elite, 4 Elvish Mystic, 4 Elvish Visionary, 4 Gnaw Root Trapper, 4 Leaf Guilder, 1 Reclamation Sage, 4 Shaman of the Pack, 4 Sylvan Messenger, 2 Dwinyan Gilt-Leaf Dayan, which is the one lord from Origins. And then he's running just 8 spells, 4 Court of Calling, and 4 Collected Company.
Wow.
And then he's just, his sideboard is 2 Gilt-Leaf Winnower, 1 Reclamation Sage, 2 Display of Dominance, 2 Plummet, 1 Bow of Nylea, 2 Isle Blight Massacre, 2 Self-Inflicted Wound, and 3 Thoughtseize.
I mean, it seems pretty straightforward, and I just elf hit you with it.
Yeah, it seems like you gotta just dump elves on the field and then maybe just Shaman of the Pack them. I know Shaman of the Pact has been talk of the town for Cocoa, like modern Cocoa Elves, because you can just, instead of going towards like the green white option, you just go towards the green black. And then like when you have a bunch of elves on the battlefield, you're like, oh, I'll just Shaman of the Pact, shoot you for like 9. Hit you for 9 because I have like all the elves in the world, and then I'll just Azuri activate his ability, give all my elves +3/+3 and trample and swing and kill you.
Seems ridiculous.
Yeah, Shaman of the Pact's like a $2 to $3 uncommon now, so
Well, I mean, it's kind of awesome to see this new kind of tribal setup they've got. I mean, it lets kind of the Johnnies of the world still do well in tournaments.
yeah, it's a cheap list. Like Collected Company and Port of Calling are the only expensive parts of the list, really. The 4 Lanwar Waste, but and 2 Mana Confluence, but that's it's 14 cards. It's not like you have to go out and buy like all 60 cards. Like you can basically just open all these and be fine.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Like you're looking for a cheap FNM or fun deck to play. I feel like this is just a good deck for that.
Yeah, I think that Green Black Elves is going to be kind of something that takes FNMs all over the country by storm. And it's good to see that it did well at a tournament like this. I've got some lists I want to talk about that did relatively okay, and I think the community as a whole, at least the Magic communities I'm a part of online and in real life, are kind of buzzing about a lot of these decks. So the first one I wanted to go over was the 18th place deck at Chicago, which was a Tarka Goblins piloted by Jason Konert. So it's straightforward goblin aggro, which I was a little sad to not see in any feature matches.
Yeah, you got 18th though, so
Right. So I mean, there's something there, and I've always found that being able to kind of when a big tournament like this happens, you get a lot of people that will copy the first, second, third, maybe the top eight, lists. And if you kind of dig a little deeper and find the lists that did okay and tune them to your own metagame, you can do really well with them. That's usually the strategy I take when I get ready for a new standard.
Yeah, even I think Patrick and Cedric even addressed this. Like they were like, a lot of people are going to be looking at the top eight, but this is a new standard format. So what you really should be doing is be looking at like the top 32 or like even the top 64 and see what decks come out to you and be like, oh, Well, now that we know what the metagame kind of looks like, let's tune this list to be towards the metagame.
Precisely, and I think one of the best examples of that is after Pro Tour M15 with Rabble Red. Rabble Red placed, I think, like 25th or maybe even lower at Pro Tour M15, and then became this huge sensation just a couple months later. And I think that it was the Pro Tour just wasn't the right tournament for it. But it ended up doing so well later on that, you know, that's when Rabble Masters jumped from like a $5 rare to like a $20 rare.
Yeah, and then when all those buy a box promos kind of skyrocketed because they were.
Yeah, so this Atarka Goblins list, a lot very similar to the original Atarka Red list that won Pro Tour Dragons of Tarkir, but the main thing being that it's almost entirely goblin. So it's got 18 creatures, 4 Foundry Street Denizen, 1 Frenzied Goblin, 1 Goblin Heel Cutter, 4 Goblin Pile Drivers, 4 Goblin Rabble Masters, and 4 Monastery Swift Spears. It's got 20 lands, one of them being a forest, 11 mountain, 4 Mana Confluence, and 4 Wooded Foothills, and 22 spells with 4 Atarka's Command, 1 Become Immense, 3 Searing Blood, 4 Stoke the Flames, 3 Wild Slash, 4 Dragon Fodder, and 3 Hordling Outburst. The sideboard consists of 2 Hornet Nest, 3 Eidolon of the Great Revel, 3 Destructive Revelry, 1 Twin Bolt, 1 Hall of Triumph, 2 Arc Lightning, 1 Harness by Force, and 2 Roast. Now, the one thing I don't like about this list is 4 Monastery Swift Spear. I mean, come on, that's not a goblin. Why would you run a really good one drop with haste and prowess when you could run another tribal goblin? But I do like this list overall. I mean, it's like I said, very similar to the original Atarka Red, but runs a little more heavily on the goblin tribal.
What interested me about this list is the hornet's nest in the sideboard. Like,
Yeah, I think that's a
I feel
very
like
strange sideboard choice for a pure aggro deck.
it's more like if he's going against like odds on aggro or something, I can understand running it. He's just like, oh, he's gonna have police mains and rakshasas and siege rhinos and anafensa. Like, I need something to like kind of hold the fort back a little bit and make them weary to like not attack me.
I think it's a solid statement about the mirror match, actually, because if you have that in against other pile drivers or rabble masters,
Seems really good.
like if your opponent has a rabble master and a pile driver on the field, so all other goblins have to attack with the exception of like the rabble master. If that pile driver's coming at you with several goblin tokens, you block that pile driver. You've got hornet tokens for days. Seems good to me.
That's interesting. Harness by force is a one of. I mean, I don't know why it's not more, but.
Well, I've seen anytime I've seen that card show up in a sideboard, it's always been a one of, and a lot of decks moved to what was it, Mob Rule, I think, the one that takes control of like all the creatures. A lot of decks moved to that as a one of in the sideboard, but I mean, Harness by Force can be one of those things where you just kind of take their Dragon Lord Atarka and go with it.
Kill them.
Exactly. And so it's kind of one of those spicy finishers that you don't want to pollute your deck too much with being a 3-drop, 2-red that can be a dead card at times. So I like it a lot as a one of in the side. And then obviously 4 Atarka's commands in the main board, just always good. Very few situations where Atarka's command is a dead card, as Justin found out against Burn in Modern.
Yeah, especially when your opponent has three of them in hand.
Exactly.
Seems
And
like a good card.
my favorite card that's in the Atarka lists, because it's so ridiculous, is Become Immense. And when Martin Dang won Pro Tour with that one Become Immense in the deck and pretty much said, well, it's just a good card, but it's, you know, also kind of crazy, so they'll just do one. I took that to a whole nother level and ran two in my Atarka list. And hardly ever, unless it's in like your opening hand, do you not like having Become Immense in your hand? because it's so easy to just use and go off with it and just blow out a game entirely.
Yeah, it seems really good.
The next lists I wanted to talk about were the ones that were kind of all the buzz in the Magic community that a lot of people are talking about. And that is Matthew Tickle's Five Color Rally, the Ancestors deck. He placed 34th overall. And did you watch any of the feature matches with this deck?
I did. And, like, at times I was just like, this deck is just so hard. It's a very difficult deck.
This deck is so difficult that Matthew Tickle decked himself in one of the rounds because he didn't order it just right.
Yeah, it's really good, though.
Yeah, it's insane. And the fact that it was able to do so well on five colors, I never saw him have trouble with mana.
Like, he has, like, he has four mana confluence, so he really shouldn't have any problems. But, like, he also has, like, he's playing, like, is he playing all the... He's almost playing all the tap lands.
Yeah.
And cons. He's just missing the Mardu one.
Right.
But he's playing every single one.
Yeah. I mean, he and the Satyr Wayfinders make it help him hit his land. The Caryatids help him get the colors he needs. But the Nantuko Husk Rally the Ancestors interaction is what really just blew it over the top. Because with Nantuko Husk, if you're not familiar with the card, it's a 3-drop, 2-colorless, 1-black creature, zombie insect, reprinted in Origins, and it's a 2/2. You can sacrifice a creature, and it gets +2/+2 until end of turn. Now, the way he would use this to interact is once he got all of his entire creature graveyard back from with Rally the Ancestors, you sacrifice them to Nantuko Husk, give it the +2/+2, they go back to the graveyard instead of getting exiled at the end of the turn. So he constantly is able to keep that engine going by not losing all of his cards in exile to Rally the Ancestors. Because when I first watched the deck before, you know, it started comboing off, I knew, you know, they said it was Rally the Ancestors, and I was like, well, you know, how's that going to work with you having to exile those creatures at the beginning of your next upkeep? But, you know, with an Nantuko Husk sacrifice engine, just became nuts. And then the whole point was to get Mogus's Marauder on, give everything haste, and make them unblockable pretty much with the Intimidate, and just go nuts. So you get lethal in one swing pretty much.
Yeah, and, like, even if you don't have the Mogus Marauder in your yard or in, like, your hand, the really powerful engine about this deck, it has Grim Harrow specs. But yep. While you're sacking all your dudes to the Nantuko Husk, you're drawing all these cards, so you're just refilling. And you can get that second rally and just be like, all right, well, I'm just going to sack my whole board to Nantuko Husk. And then it's just like, and then I'm going to rally again, and I'm going to do the same thing again until I can get my goddamn Bogus Marauder.
Yeah, and I never in my entire life thought that Mogus's Marauder would be a win condition.
When the Obzon Rally list first came into light, everyone was just like, it was the Grey Merchant Mogus Marauder deck. It was just revised and lived again. The problem with that deck, and I think Matthew goes through it in his deck tech that they did, he's like, you have Siege Rhinos and all these top end, but you really don't really want to rally for 4. Like, you have to wait till turn 6 or even like turn 5. I don't want to wait till turn 5. Like, I want to go off as fast as possible, and I want to do it in the most efficient way possible.
Well, and all of his creatures, for being under 3 CMC, he's able to rally it on turn 5.
Yeah.
And get everything. He never has to, you know, pick and choose which creatures. He can just get every single one. Including his 4 Jace, Vryn's Prodigy, and 1 Liliana Heretical Healer. So, the list overall is 30 creatures, 3 Deathmist Raptor, 2 Dem Protector, 4 Elvish Mystic, 3 Grim Haru Specs, 2 Mogus's Marauder, 4 Nantuko Husk, 4 Satyr Wayfinder, 3 Sylvan Caryatid, 4 Jace, Vryn's Prodigy, and 1 Liliana Heretical Healer. He's got 20 lands, which isn't really a lot for a deck like this, and he's only got 10 spells, 2 Court of Calling, 4 Rally the Ancestor, and 4 Gather the Pack. Now, I saw Gather the Pack do a lot of work in this deck as well, and it's a new card from Origins. It's 1 colorless and a green. You reveal the top five cards of your library. You may put a creature card from among them into your hand and put the rest into your graveyard. With a spell mastery trigger, if there are two or more instant and or sorcery cards in your graveyard, put up to two creatures from among the revealed cards into your hand instead of one. So you're essentially just having more engines to get everything you need quicker with all of this. And then we have the sideboard of four Cleric of the Forward Order, which is pretty much like Erishin Cleric, but better because it can block goblins more effectively. Den Protector, one Hidden Dragon Slayer, one Reclamation Sage, one Stratus Dancer, two Heroes Downfalls, two Kolaghan's Command, and three Thoughtseize. So, I mean, this deck is just designed to be able to do everything, and it truly is five colors once you include the sideboard.
The really, interesting about Cleric of the Forward Order is that if they're all four in your graveyard and you rally for three, they all go on the battlefield at once, so they all trigger at once. And math, I don't even remember the math, but you gain, a huge amount of life.
Yeah, it's insane, because they all trigger off of each other.
Yeah. You actually gain, I think, 32 life, because the first one triggers, you gain 8, and then the next one, gain 8. So, it's insane. I really like Cleric of the Forward Order, because it does block Pile Driver, and Erishin Cleric doesn't. There's kind of a debate on some forums that I was watching, I looked on about Obs on Control, and what are we going to do against Pile Driver decks? Pile Driver's here, everybody. We got to deal with it. And they're like, just Bio Blight it. I'm like, well, what if you don't got the Bio Blight? We got some sideboard options.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of people just split between the Cleric of the Forward Order and Erishin Cleric. And a lot of people are just like, it's good for this reason. It's good for this. Who knows where it's going to go, but I do like Cleric of the Forward Order.
It seems like a solid choice, especially in a deck like this, with a Rally the Ancestors synergy you were talking about that just makes it insane. So the last deck I wanted to talk about was the famous, or perhaps infamous, Turbo Fog from James Newman. He ended up 78th place overall. He was very close to day two-ing the tournament overall. Turbo Fog is always a strategy that is one of the many strategies I hate, just because of how it plays, and it can be very unfun at times. But it used the cards from Origins that I wasn't sure how I felt about. So the deck overall is 24 lands, which is just all 4 Forest, 8 Island, 4 Radiant Fountain, 4 Temple of Mystery, and 4 Thornwood Falls. And then it's 37 spells and no creatures. So the 37 spells are 2 Orbs of Warding, 4 Dictative Crucifix, 4 Monastery Siege, 4 Sphinx's Tutelage, 3 Aether Spouts, 4 Defend the Hearth, 3 Negate, 4 Winds of Khalsisma, 1 Alhamaret's Archive, 4 Day's Undoing, and 4 Treasure Cruise. So essentially what it boils down to is this is a mill deck. The win condition is milling. And we don't see that very often anymore. Milling, when new players say they want to play mill at a competitive tournament, competitive players laugh. But here we are with evidence showing that this could potentially be a viable strategy.
Yeah, it's Turbo Fog. We saw it during Dragon's Maze. The Dragon's Maze deck was the fog list to get to that ultimate win condition.
Yep.
And it's kind of the same thing, but your win condition is just Sphinx's Tutelage them out of the game.
Yep. Now,
you and you can't do anything about it because I have you locked down with Icefall Regents and other things.
Yeah, so for those that aren't familiar, the way this deck works is you just draw insane amounts of cards, and with Sphinx's Tutelage, which is an enchantment for 2 colors and a blue, whenever you draw a card, target opponent puts the top 2 cards of his or her library into his or her graveyard. If they're both non-land cards that share a color, repeat this process. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe when you Treasure Cruise and draw 3, Sphinx's Tutelage triggers 3 times.
Yep, it does. It triggers off each draw.
And that's insane.
Yeah, because
especially with its repeat part, because you could potentially mill them out ridiculously. And I saw it work so well against an Abzan list, because of the gold cards that share so many colors with so many other things, that it just repeated the mill so many times off of, you know, one treasure cruise, so it just kept happening over and over. And then the Monastery Siege and Dictative Crew Fix, you know, having more cards being drawn, was just made the whole deck seem ridiculous.
Also, with that artifact, where if you draw a card, you draw an extra card, Treasure Cruise draws you six.
Oh, Lord. I didn't even think of that.
Well, yeah, that's also a really cool synergy that I knew. He said in his deck tech, he was just like, yeah, I haven't done it yet, but I haven't lived the dream of drawing six off of Treasure Cruise yet, but hopefully I will.
Yeah, that seems insane.
And I know later, when he Treasure Cruise, just a normal draw three Treasure Cruise, he milled like 20 cards out of a deck.
Yeah, because, I mean, so many multicolor cards sharing in the top tier decks right now. This deck just cracks me up. And then you have in the sideboard one Grind Clock, which I've never seen play ever. Three Icefall Regent, one Pearl Lake Ancient, one Aether Spouts, two Clash of Wills, two Disdainful Stroke, one Dissolve, one Dragonlord's Prerogative, one Ugin the Spirit Dragon, and two Talent of the Telepath. Now, with one of the matches I watched, he was able to go to a more creature-oriented strategy. So he had the Icefall Regents and the Pearl Lake Ancient in. So you lock down the Icefall Regents, and then you can Pearl Lake Ancient for a control-style victory. But, I mean, he can also go into a more controlling route with more counter spells and card draw. And Ugin, even. So, I mean, there's so much going on in a deck with only creatures in the sideboard.
Yeah, one of the feature matches, he was going against Obzon Megamorph, and game three, well, like, I remember how it played out. He took game one, and then game two, he went more controlling, but he lost. So I think his thought was like, well, I'm on the play, I just need to go more aggro, which I can see that. But the thing with, like, Obzon Megamorph, you have to be controlling in that situation. You have to just keep controlling their plays, because they're just going to get an advantage over you. And that's what happened. Like, no matter what he did, he just lost, because he couldn't control the board as much as he should have.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that Cedric and Patrick talked about. They were just like, I don't understand why he went from controlling to aggro. He should have just stuck with control, because it would have benefited him more.
Yeah, I mean, while Icefall Regent and Pearl Lake Ancient are, you know, still very good creatures, it's just not what he needed to answer that kind of strategy he was up against. I'm excited for, a new standard. I still have not had a chance to play any of the new standard, but I'm hoping to in the next couple weeks or so give it a shot. There's a big tournament up in Grand Island that we're looking at. Yeah, was it the 29th of August, I think?
Yep.
There's a lot of good prizes up for grabs, so I'm excited about that.
Like, just the cash for, like, the top eight just gets me excited.
Just cash in a box. Like, we're talking hundreds of dollars, and you get a box of Magic cards, which is never a bad place to be.
Bad place.
Okay, so to finish off the cast, I wanted to review some cards that I have discovered the other day. Now, a while back, someone created a recurrent neural network that made Magic cards. And now there's a Twitter account that posts them, and it's at Robo Rosewater. And the thing was, is that when it first started out, it was coming out with some really cruddy cards that the mechanics didn't make any goddamn sense. But because it's continuously learning, because it's a neural network, the cards are starting to get better, and I'm almost wondering if Wizards is going to be put out of business by this guy. Like, Mark Rosewater might lose his job to this computer. Not literally, but it's coming out with some pretty good cards. So the names are still a little nonsensical, but I wanted to go over some of these cards. Have they shown up for you in the notes, Justin?
Yep.
All right, perfect. So I wanted to go over this first one, a sliver card, Solvital Sliver. It's two colorless and a black creature, Sliver, so it's pretty uniform. Like, it got it right so far. And then it's a 2/2, which again seems pretty slivery. All sliver creatures have, whenever this creature deals damage to an opponent, put a +1/+1 counter on it.
That's
That's a
awesome.
legit sliver.
Yeah, that's a sliver. Like, that's not like someone just is like, oh, I'm gonna put like all slivers, like, whenever they do a combo damage, they get like cumulative upkeep, like 7 or something stupid. It's like an actually legit sliver.
It really
Pretty funny.
is. And the fact that, this computer just generated this sliver that fits almost perfectly within sliver design space is astounding and kind of scary.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like a card Wizards could make.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised it's not already. Is it? I haven't checked.
It might be. There's so many slivers out there.
Yeah, I'm not going to scroll through the entire Gatherer page for slivers to find out if this already exists, but Robo Rosewater did a damn good job on this sliver. I would play this in sliver EDH, or even modern slivers.
Yeah. Modern slivers. They'd have to like reprint all the good slivers, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, they changed how the slivers work, too. So, I don't know where the deck sits now, but I haven't seen it posting any results. So, moving on to the second card is Strings the One. This is a legendary land. You tap it, add 4 mana to your mana pool, colorless. Activate this ability only during your upkeep.
All right.
What do you think of this one?
It's weird, but you could do some stuff with it because you untap, so like possibilities are endless.
Yeah, like you can cast kind you could cast some like janky instants and stuff that normally wouldn't see play
Yeah.
with something like this because you got, if they have high colorless mana cost, then, you just tap this in your upkeep and cast it, or a creature with flash or something.
Yeah, you can do anything really.
Yeah, you lose some of the value with flash of being able to end step it if you're, intent on using this card to help cast it, but still, that seems pretty legit. Like, it's scaring me a little bit, like how, like, I have a feeling that EDH players everywhere are just going to start using these.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, like, it's close enough. It's Robo Rosewater, right?
Yeah.
The one thing I find funny about this designing of cards is the names, because the names don't match any flavor usually, except the sliver ones seem to work really well. So the flavor and the colors and even the card types don't always fit. So going into the last card we have for today is Dorzer Steel Lava. It's one black and an enchantment. When Dorzer Steel Lava enters the battlefield, return Dorzer Steel Lava to its owner's hand.
Really, like, I could see potential even like in standard. You got like the constellation.
Oh
Like,
God, I didn't even think of that.
yeah, you could have like Doomwake Giants, and then you could just be like, oh, I have like 8 black. I'm gonna play this 8 times and just completely wipe your board.
Oh my
It's
God, that's insane.
yeah, like it's got combo.
Like it's
And
never going to happen, but dear God, that's insane.
like, I guess, like, if it was an EDH card, it wouldn't be bad.
Oh my God, yeah. Because, like, I read this and was like, well, that's dumb. It doesn't do anything. But, oh God, like, you can do things with it. Or, any combo with when blank enters the battlefield, or, when a permanent, or when an enchantment enters the battlefield. There's so much you can do.
Yeah.
I think if you're for combo potential, it would be better if it was a creature, because I think, I mean, and I don't know, but I think more things interact with when creatures enter the battlefield. But
Yeah.
like you said, with a constellation build, this thing would be nuts.
Yeah.
The nuts.
Not much straw.
I want to play this. I might build a Robo Rosewater cube and just play this shit, because oh my God, some of this, like, I'm just so impressed with that sliver because if you look back at like the history of this Robo Rosewater thing, like the first few cards it started designing were just dumb. But I think that's all we've got for today. Justin, did you have any shout-outs you wanted to give out?
Just want to shout out to all the people at the PPTQ. I wish you guys all good luck. You're probably not going to see any Obzon Whitleaf Liege decks there because, I'm like the only one that plays that deck still. But yeah, everyone, good luck. Have a good, fun weekend. That's really all I got. Probably just shout out to all the people that have been supporting the podcast so far. We're on the third episode already, we're this far.
And people are still listening.
Yeah, somehow people are still listening. Like.
Like.
Yeah, just gotta throw in the like in there.
We didn't get enough of that last week. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm gonna hop onto that one too and just thank everybody who's been listening. Thanks anyone who's been retweeting the links to the podcast or posting on Facebook or just giving good critique. I still getting some solid critiques from, the podcast I listen to. Still learning a lot and just appreciate the support. So you can follow me on Twitter at NerdMeat. You can follow Justin on Twitter, even though he doesn't really post anything ever.
Yeah, if you follow me, I may occasionally post something, but I'm gonna start trying to get better at Twitter. I'm gonna start tweeting more.
And see, like, I've dedicated Twitter pretty much to all my Magic rantings.
Yeah, I don't know.
I
I
was
don't really
never a
care.
big Twitterer until probably a couple months ago, and I started, not having anything to do at work, so I just tweet stuff about Magic. Like, my entire list of people I follow is, like, pro Magic players.
Yeah, I just have people from like high school, really.
Yeah, so I think that's all we got. We'll see you next time.
All right, we'll see you guys next time.